you have to speak naturally and hope you hear. So, welcome to Cornell. I'd like to talk today about robotics. And with the book that you've been reading, has a lot of interesting connections, a lot of philosophical connections. Yeah, philosophical questions about capabilities of machines and what it is to be human, and a lot of technical questions that arise. Can we make machines that can behave like humans, and how far can we push robotic technology? So, what I'd like to do today is talk to you a little bit about a couple of different projects that we've done in robotics labs here at Cornell, in the school, in the College of Engineering. And actually, most of the projects that I'll show you have been done, or many of them have been done by undergraduate students here at Cornell, from art and science, from engineering, from biology, from various colleges, and some of them even freshmen. So part of what I want to, the message that I want to convey today is that this kind of research, these kind of questions are not just philosophical, but things that you can personally be involved in during your time here, even during your first year. So keep that in mind. I'll try to point that out as I go along. Okay, so what do robots dream of? And, you know, how far can we push robotics? Can we ever make a robot that's an android? And can we ever make a robot that can actually have feelings? And a lot of the story focuses on this question of whether machines can or cannot have empathy. They have feelings towards other machines or towards other humans. And in fact, the whole principle of the book is about this idea that machines cannot really have empathy, and if we can use that to detect what's an android and what's a human. So I want to touch on this topic a little bit and show you what we've doing, what we've been doing to basically look at this question from a kind of technology point of view. So there are millions of robots out there right now working, and most of them are invisible to the eye. Most of robots today work in factories, and they are superhuman almost any way you want to measure. They are fast, they are more precise, they are more powerful, they can work 24/7, they can work in hazardous environments, they are superhuman in almost any of these capabilities, but they lack in one fundamental ability, and that is their ability to adapt to new situations. So a robot in a factory like this, and here's a robot grinding something in a factory, relies on the fact that everything is in the right place in the right time, that everything works, that all the parts are there. If something is missing, it can't improvise. If this robot breaks, it's game over. And so the ability to adapt is one of the fundamental things that research frontiers in robotics today is making machines that can adapt. And if you look at biology, biology is not as fast, as precise, as powerful as machines, but it is very good at adaptation. Adaptation is one of the biggest challenges for robotics today, and one of the things that, many people are working on. So, and what I want to argue today is the ability to have a sensation of self, a self model, and a model of other machines and other agents around is key to adaptation. The ability to react and adapt to situations, and it is not a surprise that the ability to sense what other agents feel has evolved in biology and would also be useful in robotics. So again, there's lots of robotics out there. This is a robot for a surgical robot that's again very tremendous engineering capability, precision, and so forth, but cannot adapt to the situation. Anything breaks, anything changes, this robot is over. I don't know how many of you have seen these robots that can play a violin even it looks great, but again, this robot plays the violin in a very choreographed way. Every one of its motions is carefully planned by an engineer and to generate a very specific piece of music. And even as it moves, when it plays, and so forth, it's all choreographed to look like it's really you know, feeling the music and so forth. But it's really very, very programmed. So what can we do to kind of break away from this paradigm of programming and everything? So I used to have to show the robot going to Mars or something like that in order to convince you that it's good for robots to adapt to this situation. But really, robots, as they enter homes, need to adapt to the situation. So working at home is really difficult for robots. So this is a vacuum cleaning robot. Anybody here have a Roomba home? One, two, three, four, five. Okay, a couple there. Okay, good. So a couple of you have already seen these robots. These are one of the first robots that actually work in people's homes. Okay, I have five of them at home. And they all hung in the corner and they don't work. When they're together, they do less work than them. So that's it. You have to lock them in the incredible room. So these robots are entering homes, and a home is much, in a house, is much more difficult to work in than a factory, because everything is in a different location every time. A kid's life is robot, and all kinds of things happen. So it's really a challenging environment for a robot, and that's one of the things you need to address. So a while ago, we started with this idea of, you know what, let's forget about sitting at a desk and designing robots from scratch. Let's bring in the mother of designers. Let's bring in evolution to design robots for us. Let's breed robots. And so we started off, this was about a couple days ago, we said, okay, let's take a gaming simulator, let's throw in millions of parts of robots, bars, joints, wires, motors, neurons as neural networks, and let's breed robots. Let's just let these pieces connect and disconnect in random ways, and we'll test all these pieces of junk, and robots that can, let's say, move faster than others, we'll get to reproduce. We'll make more copy of them. And after a while, we'll get a machine that can walk or move in some interesting way. And we'll just breathe there for a commotion. And indeed, for a long while, nothing happened. We just got lots of pieces of junk in simulation. But after a while, something interesting happened. A couple of pieces of junk happened to have a motor connected to something that generated a signal. And these pieces of junk vibrated a little bit. And because they vibrated a little bit, they moved a little bit. And even though that wasn't a very good way of moving, it was infinitely better than all those other pieces of junk that didn't move at all. And so those vibrating pieces of junk immediately took over the population. And then they started to improve. And after a while, maybe a couple hundred thousand generations, they got really interesting machines. Two of them are shown here. These are two machines that kind of crawl across the table. And they have kind of brain that makes them do that, and it's not showing right now, but here's this machine over here, in fact, almost looks like it was intelligently designed. It's kind of symmetrical, it wiggles its tails, and it kind of moves between that, because that was kind of a simple brain that evolved. So these are very simple machines produced by this evolutionary process. Here you can see more of them. Every time you run it, you get different machines, and here are two of these machines actually working in parallel. And again, these are not fantastic robots in their ability to move, but they were designed by this evolutionary process, given a set of building blocks. Is there a hand? Okay, feel free to ask anything at any time. Part of this is supposed to be a discussion, so the only way for me to all you're paying attention is you ask yourself, yeah.
How long was the simulation run?
That was back in 2000. So it took a couple of days on a big 16 processor machine. And today you can run on your iPhone. Yeah, but back then it was a big deal. In fact, I think you still download this thing as a screensaver. And you can call machines on your desktop. So, an interesting thing I want to point out, this is not the main thing of the talk, but I just can't help myself but point this out, how we made this robot. This robot was printed. If you're familiar with 3D printing, anybody here familiar with this, with 3D printing? Pretty good. The proportion is gradually increasing from year to year. For those of you who haven't heard about it, I'm going to tell you what it is, and remember, you heard it first here. Okay? 3D printing is, so you know what an inkjet printer is, right? So an inkjet printer spits out droplets of ink, a piece of paper, creates an image. So imagine that instead of droplets of ink, we'll spit out droplets of plastic. We gradually make a pattern of plastic, a sheet of plastic. Some places pulls plastic, some places it doesn't. Then it moves up a tenth of a millimeter, creates another layer of plastic. And then a tenth of a millimeter, and another layer. And after a couple of hours, you have a three-dimensional object. Star Trek replicate. Visually. You can print a cup, pull it out of the printer, and go and drink some water. Okay, a three-dimensional object. And, it's amazing technology. It's been around for about, 20 years, but it's been very, very expensive, school, etc. These things are coming down in cost. And I bet that in 20 years, you'll have it at home, and you'll download things off the internet to print them. Okay? And in, 40 years, you'll have a hard time explaining to your grandchildren how it was possible to live without a 3D printer in the future. You actually have to buy something and wait for a whole week until it will ship to you. Right? Remember you heard it here first. So anyway, we printed the robot, but we couldn't print the wires. See, we printed all the white stuff is printed because it's evolved, crazy shape. We couldn't print the wires and the batteries. Now we can print the wires and the batteries. And then we made a printer in the lab. This is all on the larger part. They can make print wires and batteries and all of it. So it's pretty cool. Alright, so back to the main point. Okay, so the reason why this first project worked was because we could simulate everything. Okay, we evolved millions of robots, okay, thousands of generations, thousands of robots, and we'll work the simulation, transfer it into reality, because the robots were very, very simple. They just kind of crawled around. Very simple behavior. But there's a problem but if the robot becomes more complicated, what works in simulation doesn't necessarily work in reality. And so our next project, was to say, okay, let's try to do this with a really complicated robot. So we built this robot to impress our engineering colleagues. This is, it has 12, pistons here, and it has, in the center, it has a paintball canister. Okay? Highly pressurized paintball canister, and it has a set of valves here, and there's a computer that basically, like, plays the piano, turns the valves on and off, and as it turns the valves on and off, these pistons move back and forward. The goal is to make this machine move forward. So, now, whereas before, this is what it looks like in the center. So, whereas before we evolved the robot body, now we're going to evolve the robot brain, okay? The thing that makes the place of piano, decides how to open and close the valve. So, it's going to be the same robot. There'll be thousands of brains competing on how to control this robot to turn the valves on and off. And so, we put this robot in a cage right here. And we have a camera, and the camera sees this red ball. This is the camera view. And then we let a candidate robot program run on this robot and make the robot wiggle and do its thing. And then the camera watches the red ball and determines how fit the robot is. Okay? And then it takes the program that did better and recombines them and produces new robots, new programs and so forth. So we let this thing run for a while. It's like a rodeo show. We make all kinds of programs trying to make all kinds of things. The beginning is crazy and gradually the robot begins to move. And here's a playback of this robot. And you can see in the beginning, it's not doing very much. And if she's not going to take over the world anytime soon. But nonetheless, it's learning how to walk. And it's surprising that this kind of random evolutionary process can make anything want to do anything at all. And it's gradually learned. So the idea is that you throw a robot like this in the environment and you kind of learn as it goes. Alright. Okay, so we saw two projects here, yeah.
How did you teach us how to do scientific robot
Okay, so basically we have a kind of evolutionary process where is you have initially random programs. That's what you saw in the beginning. Kind of wiggles doesn't go anywhere. You know, random programs. They can go backwards as well as forward, sideways, whatever. And then for each of them, you can measure how well it did, either using an external camera or on board with a camera. You can see how far it's moving. And then let's say it takes the top 50% and copies them with random variations and overwrites the bottom 50%. That does that again. That's it. That's the whole program. It's evolved, and after a couple of thousand times or maybe a hundred times of doing that already, it's going to work. Very, very simple idea. Yeah?
Did you like program those variations where you're not
connected? Random. It's random variations. So you're not program. Yeah.
Does the program specify to
robot
or walk?
It can do other things, and we'll see some examples here. It was specifically how to move, so not even walk. Just can move in terms of gravity, but you can ask it to evolve to do something else, like climb or recognize spaces, whatever it is you want it to do. And more interestingly, I don't have slides for that, but if you take robots and you don't evolve them to do anything, you don't reward them to do anything in particular, then it's really interesting to see what they want to do. So, and one of the things that comes out there is self-duplication, which is what we want to do, but it's a longer story. Yeah.
What if man has to walk? Does it man have to walk in the best possible way?
Local max is an excellent question. So the thing that it, so does the robot find the optimal way to walk? No, it finds the local. So let me show you now the problems in this thing. Okay, so the first project, we did everything in simulation, in the gaming simulator. We then downloaded it onto, we then took the best robot, we built it, we crossed our fingers, we turned it on, and it worked, but it only worked because it was a very simple robot. It would not have worked if it was a complicated robot because there was a gap between what we could simulate and what we have. And this is something we call it robotics or engineering, crossing the reality gap. If you will work with simulations and simulators, as scientists and engineers, you'll quickly find out that what you can simulate on a computer doesn't necessarily happen in reality. There's a gap, stuff happens in reality, and there's a gap that needs to be crossed. And so, this kind of doesn't work for very complicated machines. Second project I showed you, there was no simulator. We just let the robot learn, physical robot, we let it learn. And it just tried it always in reality. So there was no simulation involved. It was all nice. The problem there was what? What's the challenge with this approach? Okay, yeah. Takes a lot of time, exactly. In fact, it's very costly. In time, it wears out the robot, it's risky for the robot, it takes a lot of energy and so forth. Okay? So, too many people try. In fact, we proposed to NASA to do this, and there was no way they could let us, do the driving trial with the robot on Mars. It's too risky if they break the robot, you don't guarantee it to work. Alright, so we have this problem. Either we do everything in simulation, but then it doesn't match reality, or we do it on a physical robot that takes more. Okay, so what do we do? So I want to show you a third approach, which will lead me to this idea of a self-image and ultimately to this question of empathy. Right? And I know you don't see the connection yet, but you will soon. So here's the main idea, right? So we start off with a simulator. maybe a very bad simulator, not a very good one. We then use it to evolve robots. We then take our best robot and try it in reality. Now, because we started with a bad simulator, the robot is not going to work well in reality. It's going to go around, it's not going to do very well. But we collect data from that robot. We collect sensory data. And when I say sensory data, I mean data related to actuation and sensation, how it moves its motors and what it senses, accelerations, images, whatever, okay? Relationship between actuation and sensation. This is what we collect. We then use that information to evolve better simulators. Okay, so whereas before I talked about evolving robots, now I'm talking about evolving simulators. Okay, a simulator is this program used to in which is this virtual world, virtual gaming world, if you like, in which we did our first project. Now, what's the figure of merit of fitness of a simulator is how well it retrospectively predicts the relationship between activation and sensation. A good simulation will correspond retrospectively to reality, and a bad simulator will not. We then take the best simulator, use it to generate a new robot, try it out again, it probably won't work very well, but we'll get more data, we'll have even better simulator, and then we keep on doing that. We're doing very few physical trials, and we're gradually creating a simulator. In fact, we're co-evolving robots and simulators. And what I want to argue, it's a little bit philosophical, is this simulator is the self-image that we have in our minds right now. Each one of us has a mental picture of ourselves, where we can see ourselves doing things. And what will happen if we try to run down the stairs or climb a tree? We can see ourselves doing that, and we can predict the sensations that we'll feel if we'll do certain things or not do certain things. And we use that to plan. This ability to co-evolve simulators is the key to have this ability to plan and predict. So let me show you a third project. This is a four-legged robot, as you can see. It has eight motors, two on each leg, one at the hip and one at the knee, and it has two sensors that can tell you how it's tilted left and right for these batteries. Okay? Eight motors, two sensors. Now this robot needs to learn how to walk. That's a pretty weird robot because all I can do is lift its legs up and down. Okay? It's not obvious how a robot like this could walk. But here's the challenge. The robot itself does not know what it looks like. So imagine yourself sitting in a black box, no windows or nothing, eight knobs. And you can turn these eight knobs, and as you turn the knobs, the box tilts, you can feel it tilting left and right towards the back. And you need to figure out how to make this box move in a certain direction. That's the challenge that this robot is facing. It does not know if it's a snake, it's a spider, it's a tree, has no clue what it actually looks like. So it's a pretty challenging problem, maybe not unlike what the brain of a newborn child feels. It is connected to all the actuators, so to speak, and it has all these sensations, so you have to sort out what's what. So how will that robot work? So let me show you how this works, and we'll learn how to move using this idea that I just presented. So the idea, so we'll start off by having the robot do a random motion. So it's just randomly move its motors, and it will sense box looking left and right toward the diagonals. It will then try to create lots of simulations of itself, lots of hypotheses of what it might look like. Lots of simulators, if you like. All kinds of shapes. But you'll see this in the movie in a moment, and you'll know that many, if not all, of these models are incorrect. But you only know that because you happen to know what the truth is. But insofar as the robot knows, any of these might be true because they match its sensations and its actuation and sensation. You will then, and here's a really critical step, you will figure out what's the next action to do that causes the most disagreement between competing models. Why disagreement? Why the most disagreement? Because the most disagreement, when it actually does the physical action, will allow it to rule out some of the hypotheses. It's like a scientist designing an experiment that causes the most disagreement between two competing theories. Because then the result of the experiment will rule out at least one of the theories. So the robot will look for the character of actuation that causes the most disagreement between predictions of self-monitoring. Okay, we'll then perform that action, see what the actual sensation is, rule out some of the self-models, and keep on doing that. At some point, it will converge, all these models will be identical, we'll then use the resulting model to figure out how to learn how to walk, and because the model was pretty close to reality, what makes the model, self-model walk, will make the robot walk as well.
Yeah. Great. So what's the goal for the goal?
Well, in the first year, its goal here is just to create a self-model that is predictive of reality, regardless of moving or walking or climbing or anything. It just has to retrospectively predict the relationship between actuation and sensation across all tests. Okay? The self-model has to match all your experiences, regardless of what they want. Let's see how that works, and we'll take it from there. So here's the first experiment. We put the robot on the floor and let it explore itself. Okay, there it goes. That's too bad. In fact, that's going to remind you of the fact that you don't want the robot, you don't want it yourself, but you don't want to explore too far beyond what you already know. Because it might be dangerous. I don't want to walk off the cliff just to see what it feels like. So we kind of change the robot a little bit, and this is what happens. The robot now performs more slowly here. Okay? This is its first random movement. Here are all the self models it created. Now you can see they're all wrong, but they all cause the center block to tilt in the same way. So far as the robot knows, these are valid self images. Okay? This is already the 8 out of 16 trials. It's beginning to figure out it has 4 legs. It doesn't quite get there. And this is already the 16th out of 16 trials. And we pretty much figured out it has 4 legs, how they're connected, and so forth. Now, with that self-image, it can learn how to walk, just like the first project I showed you. This is rewarding it for moving. You know, we were kind of hoping for an evil spider you want, but instead, you get this lame way of moving. Right. So now when you look at this robot, you have to remember again that this robot did not do trials of locomotion. It was not given a model of itself, and it was not programmed to learn how to walk. Okay? All this happened spontaneously. Let me show one more thing eventually. So to test it, we did a very cool thing. We removed the leg. You have empathy for the sheep. Okay, and see what happens. The robot quickly sees that the actions do not match the predictions of the simulator. It adapts its self-model very quickly. It loses its self-image, loses the leg as well. And in fact, it doesn't quite lose it. It just makes it very small here. And then it learns how to move without a leg. Now, again, this is not the best or optimal way of moving without a leg. But it's surprising that it moves without a leg at all. Okay, this is, again, not programmed. There's nothing, no program in there. There's no sensor that says, leg came off, switch to plan B. This is not programmed, this is all spontaneous, emerging from this idea of self-model.
Well, you said before that, when you reward the robot for it to be the survivor, how do you reward the robot?
In this case, the processes that we use here are all evolutionary based. And in evolutionary, the reward is self-replication. So things that do what you want, you make more copies of them. That's it. So it has an internal model, Then figures out how to walk, which means it generates programs that make the model walk. And those that make it move forward get to reproduce more than those that don't make it move forward. Okay, so it's very simple. Okay. Alright, so when you look at this, you have to again remember, when we showed this movie, we published this paper, it was in newspapers, Terminator, okay, robot keeps moving even when it's broken and all that. But it's not about moving when it's broken, it's about this idea of self-love. A machine that creates a model of itself, creates a self-image, if you like. Possibly the same kind of self-image that each one of you have in your head right now of yourself, and uses that. Okay, and let me just show you a little bit of statistics. Here's what the red dots are what a random program makes a robot do, where it ends up, if it starts at the origin. The black dots are what the robot perceives using its self-image, where it will end up after walking, and the blue dots are where it actually ends up. Okay, so what does this tell us? It tells us that the robot's self-model is somewhat inflated, right? Because it thinks it can do something, it actually tries it and doesn't do it quite well. But the interesting thing is that even though the self-model is inflated, it still is useful in guiding the robot to what I want. Okay, so the self-model, self-image, doesn't have to be accurate to be useful. Right? It can be also inaccurate, but still help us learn. And there's a question, I showed this at a social science conference, and the question immediately was, is it better to have an inflated self-image or a deflated self-image? In what ways do impairments to the self-image affect progress of the robot? And so there are lots of interesting connections here between social science and psychology and cognitive science and robotics through these kinds of questions. All right, so I want to end this talk with this idea of robots modeling other robots. Okay? So after all, the kind of theme of the book that we've been reading is empathy. It's about the ability to understand feelings of someone else, to understand how someone else feels, being in their shoes, walking in their shoes. Now that is something, if you want to study this in terms of robotics, it means can a robot completely create a kind of model, not of itself, but of another robot, just by looking external. And that touches on this topic that's called theory of mind, this idea that machines can have, that people, some animals, like primates, and possibly some birds, can have mental states that contain the mental states of others. Okay, so if Jack has a mental state, Jill might be able to look at Jack and kind of figure out what the mental state of Jack is just by observation. And Jack can do that personally, and so we can keep on doing that. Okay? And to an extent, a lot of social behavior is based on our ability to model and perceive other machines or other humans, other animals, and what they're trying to do. So a lot of people have tried to do this, to make mind reading machines. They don't always work. Okay? It's been a very difficult challenge. We'll try to do it. That's why we're starting off by having a robot try to read the mind of another robot instead of read the mind of the human body, because it's simpler, everything's transparent, we can check ourselves. And so we start with a robot that has a mental state, very simple mental state, it's a robot, an observer that looks at this robot, and then the actor tries to, again, they all try to reverse engineer what each other's thinking. Okay, so here are the actual robots. I'm going to show you. These are basically wheeled robots. Here's a robot. There are two big flat wheels. And this round over here is just something that we can track with the tracking system. Alright, so the robot has a simple The actor robot has a very simple neural network brain that makes it do something. For example, it will always go towards the light. Okay, then, and this is the actual robot, you can see the moon and so forth. And then the robot will look at this robot, an observer robot, will look at this actor robot and try to figure out what it's trying to do and how. Okay, how is, if it's going to the light or maybe away from the light, does it go straight line? Does it, what does it do? Try to basically feel what that robot is feeling, figure out how it's moving. So we're going to do exactly the same kind of thing I did with a four-legged robot. Okay, the actor robot is not, these are terms from psychology. The actor will basically learn a way to move towards the light. It's not necessarily going to move in a straight line, it's going to move in some wacky way. Okay, an observer robot will look at the robot and how it goes towards the light, and look at it in different, move the light around in order to elicit different behaviors from the observed robot. Based on that knowledge, it will reverse engineer the mind of the actor robot. It will basically figure out how it's thinking, and then it will figure out where to put the light in order to make the actor robot fall into the trap. Okay, that's the story. Now, so here's a robot. Now, here's the challenge. If the actor robot just moves in a straight line, then it's really easy for an observer robot to see what that actor robot is doing, right? Because it's behaving in a very predictable way. But if the actor robot, so it'll be very easy to put a trap on it. But if the actor robot is moving in some complicated way, then the observing robot really needs to read its mind, so to speak, in order to figure out where to put the trap. Alright, so let me just show you the result of this thing. Here's the light, and this is the actor robot, and you can see this robot is moving towards the light in a very weird way. And okay? It started here, we would expect that it would just go in a straight line. But no, it has this peculiar behavior, and it moves in a strange way. So that observing robot, you can for a moment pretend that you are the observing robot, you see this behavior, and now it is your goal to figure out where to put this light in order to make this robot fall into this trap. Okay? The robot starts here, putting the light across from the trap obviously doesn't make the robot fall into the trap. The robot is thinking, its thoughts are more complicated. So our observing robot looked at this movie and figured out how that robot is thinking and decided to put the light here. This is a very weird way, a weird location to put the light. But let's see if that works. Well, first, let's see if I can play the video. Okay, so the robot, the actor robot, is doing its thing, and let's see what happens. So you can see the light is here, and the trap is there. So the point of that was to show you a machine that looks at another machine and reverse the way it's thinking, reverse engineer the way it's thinking, and then manipulate that robot based on that. So that's a very simple example. I know it has nothing to do with the complexity of human behavior and so forth. These are very, very simple machines, all this walking and light seeking, very simple behaviors. But nonetheless, I think they embody these very simple and very important principles and very important questions. So one is, I've showed you this idea of self-reflection. It's not just about robots learning to walk, being programmed to do this or that, working in a factory, driving quickly, and playing chess. These are machines that create a self-image. Okay, they create an image of themselves based on their own experience. And then they can use that self-image to do things, to do new things without planning. So to plan and do new things without having to physically try things out. We saw self-reflection of body, and the machine created an image of its own body, a self-image of its own body. And we saw self-reflection of brain, basically a machine creating a model of a brain or thinking of another robot, including from observation. We saw a machine working, modeling itself, and a machine modeling another machine. It's a very simple example, but I argue that it's the same principle as the more complex kind of self-reflection we see in animals and humans. Now, why is this useful? Why should we be studying this at all? Well, first, there's a very pragmatic reason. Okay, this is a very useful thing, because we can have machines that can diagnose themselves, can figure out if something is wrong, can even repair, and most importantly, can adapt in the situation. And you saw a robot with a lost leg learning how to walk. Again, it's not the best way to walk, but it did that spontaneously without having to try physically too many times and without having to be programmed. Okay, so there's a practical reason why we want to do this. We can have machines that can model and adapt more quickly, and that's really becoming important as machines are becoming increasingly complex, and it's difficult for engineers to foresee and account for every possible mode of failure. That's something we used to do as engineers, but it's becoming increasingly difficult, and at some point we have to let the machines take care of themselves. But the more interesting thing, I think, in the long term is I think that this is on the path to having machines have feelings. Because the moment you have a self-model and you can predict what's going to happen to you in various situations, that's, I think, a path to having feelings, emotions, and being able to also have emotions and predictions about other machines, which is the key to empathy. So kind of one of the things that I felt when I was reading this book, that this book was indeed written a couple of decades ago, and the kind of predominant thinking at that time was that androids and robots and whatever are programmed by humans. And Asimov had this thing about the three laws that are programmed into every computer. And this book, also the story, has this thing about the company that makes the Nexus 6 and all these different types of things that they program it to do this and that. But really what we're seeing more and more in robots, in robotics, is that they are not programmed. They learn and they evolve. And we do not have direct control over what they do or they don't do. It is much more of it depends on the experiences we provide them and the experiences that they learn from. So I'll leave you with these thoughts, and I'll be happy to take any more questions. And I want to just emphasize once again that on a side note, that most of these projects have been done by undergraduate students in the lab for credit during all 4 years of freshman senior year. So if you're interested in any of these things, from the philosophy of this to the programming to the design to any of this, 50 different angles you can take for this project. Do not hesitate to contact faculty and do this kind of research. It's very useful. Thank you.